Thank you, Ellie. May I have a seat, please? This afternoon, our first case is Stephen Brett Riles versus the City of Inglewood. May I have the entry of appearances, please? First of the point.
The court, my name is Tom Rice. I'm trying to get the appellant here to see if they will.
Counsel?
Good afternoon. I'm Dan Williams. I'm with me is Jennifer Sullivan and Mr. Daniels. We're here on behalf of Mr. Riles.
Okay, and I've said it correctly, Riles?
Yes.
Thank you very much. All right, counsel, this case is set for 1 hour. That means each side has 30 minutes before, so you'll have to keep track of your own time if you wish to use it. You may go ahead whenever you're ready.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The City of Inglewood asks that the certified question be answered in the negative. That is to say, the City of Inglewood asks that this court find that Ordinance 34 is not preempted by Colorado law. Now, in any preemption case, the threshold question, of course, to be asked is whether or not a particular matter is one of statewide, mixed, or local concern. And in this particular case, if it's accepted, as the trial court found, that this is a matter of mixed concern, and I would note that the appellee, the plaintiff here, conceded as much in the briefing that was done in the 10th Circuit when they said that they believe that that had been found correctly by the trial court. But if that's accepted to be true, then the only issue that remains for determination is whether or not Ordinance 34 conflicts with any state law. That is to say, any statute or regulation. Now, the trial court's order doesn't speak to that. In fact, the trial court's order doesn't identify any law that Ordinance 34 is said to be in conflict with. Instead, the trial court's order speaks in terms of policy interests and goals as opposed to statutes and regulations. And in my view, that's the fatal flaw in the trial court's order. The failure to specify a law, a state law, with which Ordinance 34 is said to be in conflict. Considering the state laws that even speak to the issue of residency for registered sex offenders, there are very few of them. But when we look at all of those laws, we find that not a single one of them is in conflict with Ordinance 34. The first such laws that's identified by the plaintiff in the briefing is what are referred to as the Sex Offender Management Board, and sometimes that acronym is just referred to short as SOM, the SOM guidelines. Now, I note at the outset that these SOM guidelines are not statute, they are not regulation. But even if we consider them as potentially state law with which 434 might be in conflict, we find that there is no such conflict. Because the SOM guidelines speak only to conditions of residence. Examples, a sex offender, particularly under a period when they are under acute supervision following release from prison or on probation, is not allowed to live in a place where there are children. They are required to give notice of their status as a registered sex offender to those who they reside with. But there's nothing in the SOM guidelines that speak to this issue of place of residence. So in the end result, there's no showing that Ordinance 34 conflicts with any of the SOM guidelines. In fact, it's the case that all the SOM guidelines can be fulfilled, and the person can also comply with Ordinance 34. Stated differently, Ordinance 34 does not defeat any of the SOM guidelines. It's also important to note that none of the SOM guidelines applied to this particular plaintiff, Mr. Riles. He was, at the time of the events involved in this case, long since released from parole. It was under no supervision whatsoever from the state, save one thing, and that is he was required under the Colorado Sex Offender Registration Act to register his place of residence. Outside of that, there was no state supervision whatsoever of this particular plaintiff. Now, I also note, before I leave the SOM discussion, the trial court considered it significant that the legislature had tasked SOM with making recommendations regarding living arrangements and specifically about safety issues that were raised by the residents of a sex offender that proximity to a school. And that's expressed at CRS 16-11.7-103, subsection 4G. But the product that resulted from that chart, there was a report on safety issues from 2004. This is found in the record at pages 898 to 900. In that report, the SOM makes no recommendations whatsoever regarding residences of sex offenders as it relates to schools, daycare centers, and the like. They simply don't make any recommendations. In fact, in the words of the SOM report itself, proximity to schools was not specifically analyzed. That's at page 899 of the record. So the bottom line is that though SOM was charged with making recommendations concerning these issues, they made none, and there was no resulting law that came from that would conflict with Ordinance 34.
Counsel, can I just get you to anticipate what your opposing counsel will respond to that, which is essentially the state has given SOM, said, hey, go forth and consider these issues, and so the fact that your municipality has done something not sanctioned by the board, let's say, that is a conflict. Can you respond to that?
What strikes me that there's only a conflict if we talk in operational terms, if there's something that the SOM mandates or even recommends that's not consistent with what the city's doing. We simply don't have that here. SOM has not spoken to this issue in place of residence, save for the fact, and I'll speak to this here in a few minutes, that they made a recommendation later in 2011 to the legislature that the legislature consider enacting a statute which would ban these kinds of local ordinances. So that's the only thing they've ever recommended with regard to place of residence. And it strikes me that if they're recommending to the legislature that they enact a statute which bans these kind of ordinances, that would seem to suggest that there is no state law at present that conflicts. Because if it's already preempted, why would they need to enact a law that does that, preempts those kinds of statutes, cheating ordinances?
Thank you.
Can I ask one question?
Of course.
Do you think that scheme could be read to indicate that the legislature intended for this particular board to be the only ones to legislate or promulgate guidelines with regard to this subject matter?
I don't think so, because it's expressed as to make recommendations. Recommendations to me are something to be acted upon in the future, as opposed to legislating or propounding regulations or something along those lines. Simply asking for recommendations. In the 2003, they made no recommendations whatsoever. In 2004, they made no recommendations whatsoever on this point.
If it could be read that way, would that be a form of conflict?
Again, it seems to me that there's got to be more than just a theoretical conflict. There's got to be a real conflict. So the idea that SOM might have some authority in this regard without having gone the next step of enacting something doesn't create a conflict.
Council, may I ask a question about that 2004 report? I'm looking at something, I think maybe this 2004 report, at least it lays out the statutory directive to the SOMB to provide recommendations about location of sex offender residencies. And as I read the report, it does seem to suggest that, at least the finding or conclusion, the suggestion that residency restrictions don't create a deterrent effect, and in fact might be counterproductive, and therefore, at least we don't recommend that residency restrictions be imposed. Mm-hmm. So how is that? I mean, can we at least read that as a recommendation to the legislature that residency restrictions are a bad idea as a policy matter?
There's two answers to that. The first is that the data that's analyzed in that report, it reaches the conclusion that you're referring to, specifically says that we did not study proximity to school. Proximity to school was not specifically analyzed. But then they glean from the fact that there was no, they did a plot where the people lived.
They examined
that. They couldn't see any pattern there associated with the place. But I think they're very clear in disclaiming the fact that they did any specific analysis on that point. But I think the more important point, the second point, is that then when we get to the recommendation section of the report, there's no recommendations whatsoever with regard to this issue. So they just simply didn't speak to it.
So maybe I misunderstand, but under this recommendation two, placing restrictions on the location of correctionally supervised sex offender residences may not deter from reoffending and should not be considered as a method to control sexual offending recidivism. It strikes me as at least a recommendation that restrictions are not a good idea.
But not as a recommendation for regulation,
okay.
Statute.
That's a distinction you're drawing. Not saying you pass a law that says pass. Okay.
I mean, in my construct, if we look at the decisions of this court with regard to this issue of operational conflict, I think what we find is that in every instance, the conflict was between the local ordinance and the state statute for regulation. And that's the distinction I'm attempting to draw here, because the trial court in this case could identify no such regulation or statute, and instead relied upon what he saw to be objectives, goals, policies, that sort of thing. And I don't think this court has extended preemption to something quite that oblique.
So what would that law have to look like in your mind?
I mean, the clearest case would be if this General Assembly had enacted the law recommended by some in 2011. Namely, they passed a law that says that from this point forward, no local government agency shall pass a law regarding the residence of a registered sex offender.
Is that the only type of law that would?
No, that would be the clearest example.
Okay.
But suppose that the legislature enacted laws or regulations through one of the agencies that then specified areas where they could and couldn't live, and that would not be consistent with Ordinance 34, then it seems to me we have an operational conflict there. Or if they gave specific charge to some, say a parole agency, that they are to place these people, not assist, but actually place them, much in the manner that we had in the Ibarra case. Now Ibarra is another situation altogether, very complicated case in a lot of ways. But I just compare it to that because in Ibarra, one of the major differentiating points between our case is in that case, the state inarguably exercised significant control over the plaintiffs. In fact, to the point where they were actually doing placement into a licensed foster care home. Whereas in the case here, Mr. Riles has no state mandate, assistance, any kind of control whatsoever.
Yeah, now this just may be troubling me, and I hear your argument. However, in what other circumstance where someone has completed their sentence, goes back to the community, I guess this is an idea of restored justice, and has to register like this so it's known where this person lives, has a city or governmental entity in Colorado banned a person from buying a house within the city, basically.
You're asking for a comparable circumstance?
Yeah, this may not be the right cause of action, I don't know, but something just doesn't seem right about it.
Yeah,
so what do we do with that?
I can't offer you a comparable circumstance, but on the other hand, really there's nothing quite comparable to CSORA, the Registration Act.
Well, I understand that, but the registration is there to notify the community. What is that? That's lifetime, right?
No, it's 10 years in this case.
Okay. It could be longer.
10 years after release from parole.
Yeah, but it troubles me then that in effect the city is zoning out substantial property that can't be bought and enjoyed by a person who has been rehabilitated in society and is abiding by the registration requirement.
Right. But one would think that if he's required to register under CSORA, that there's therefore been a determination made by the state that there's a potential public safety danger associated with him. Otherwise, there would be no point in registration.
So that rationale is you can ban him entirely from the city limits?
Well, he's not entirely banned because there are residences that are not within the concentric circles.
Yeah, so how much area of Englewood is available for him to purchase a house?
Well, the testimony on the city map, so the city has its own map that it uses to enforce the ordinance, and that identifies 126 parcels 209 addresses that are not within the banned area.
209 out of how many?
209, I'm not sure how many. I think everybody agreed it was something in the neighborhood of 99% of the city was off limits.
Yeah.
But that, I need to add to the record here, Justice Hobbs, that 209 is the total number of parcels, but there's 126 of those that are residential parcels. So we're talking 126 as per the city map. Now, the expert employed by the plan came up with a lesser number.
Okay. Well, thanks for your answers.
Mm-hmm. You know, that, before I leave the CSOAR thing, I think there's something that's really important to speak to here. One of the main themes of the plaintiff argument, both in this court and then at the trial court, was that Colorado has enacted this comprehensive system for handling registered sex offenders, all of which is individualized assessment and evidence-based. And they claim that because Ordinance 34 doesn't employ a similar system, therefore it's at odds with it. The problem with that argument is that CSOAR, the triggering legislation for our ordinance, makes no such individualized assessment, none whatsoever. Anybody who's convicted of one of these crimes and is within the time period following release is required to register. So to be required by CSOAR to be registered, one doesn't have any individualized assessment. One doesn't have any type of specific finding with regard to danger. They're all presumably such. So if you look at it from the standpoint that our Ordinance 34 works off of CSOAR, there's no inconsistency there whatsoever. Both simply presume that if you're within the registration time frame, that there's a potential public safety issue associated with that person. Another law that plaintiff points to as perhaps providing some inconsistency with Ordinance 34 is CRS 17-22.5-403, and this is the statute that directs the parole board to provide, and I quote, provide assistance in securing housing. I've already drawn the distinction between the bar, where it wasn't just providing assistance, it was actually providing a placement, so it's very different in that regard. But the record here in our case shows that, in fact, the parole board provides essentially no assistance whatsoever to registered sex offenders with regard to finding housing. The testimony was that perhaps they might provide vouchers for temporary housing, but after that, the registered sex offender is on his own. How that can be considered preemptive, I don't understand. Because if the state, in fact, is taking no action whatsoever with regard to a particular person, or any of them, how can that be said to be preemptive?
Excuse me. Mr. Reza, good afternoon.
Yes, Justice.
I'm distracted a little bit here with another line of question. How about Mr. Ryle's individual circumstance? How does that impact? Because there's a lot of conversation about some hypothetical situations, but how does, do you think his individual circumstances impacts our analysis?
I think it does greatly. From the standpoint that the issue, as I see it, the paramount issue is conflict between state law and the ordinance. And there is simply no state law that governs Mr. Riles, with the exception of CSOAR. That's the only one in his individual circumstance. And because of that, there can be said to be no inconsistency, because Order 34 is by no means inconsistent with CSOAR. It's simply requiring somebody who is registered not live in a particular area. So I think his individual circumstance is very important in the analysis of this case.
Thank you.
Now, and this is another point that's exactly a follow-up question there, is that the plaintiff also says that the registration requirement itself, that CRS 16-22-101, conflicts with Ordinance 34. But as I said, it really isn't in conflict at all. It's complementary. CSOAR says absolutely nothing about place of residence, except in one way, and it says, if their local agency is required to accept the registration of an offender, but if it includes a residence that would violate local ordinance, they don't have to. So CSOAR itself makes reference to the fact that there may be a local ordinance that speaks to where a registered sex offender can live. And that seems to need to be recognition. There's an ability of local government agencies to legislate in this area. Otherwise, there'd be no reason whatsoever for recognizing the fact that there might be a local ordinance that says that they can't live in a particular place. Plaintiff also says that it's in conflict because one other individual, a gentleman by the name of Wetman, is said to not registered. And so the idea is that because 34 doesn't allow people to live in certain places, they, quote, go underground, end quote, and just don't register. And they put Mr. Wetland up as an example of that. But if we look at the record, the case is truly very ambiguous as to whether or not Mr. Wetland was in Englewood at all, whether or not his failure to register had anything to do with Ordinance 34. There simply is no record on that. And even if we consider that Mr. Wetland's case is on point, that's one case. So how can one case be said to create an operational conflict, even under circumstances where it's not the plaintiff involved here? It seems to me that that's hardly a destruction of the state interest, as suggested by the LaPlata versus Roman Edwards case. Plaintiff also claims that the Ordinance 34 deprives individuals of the ability to reintegrate into the community. The idea is that if people want to reintegrate, they need the support structures of family, community, and that sort of thing. But the problem with that analysis is the plaintiff hasn't cited a single case where a person tried to return to Englewood and was restricted from doing so by Ordinance 34, where there was this history of support. In fact, the ordinance itself has a grandfather clause. And it says that if you establish a residency before you committed the crime, Ordinance 34 doesn't apply. You can go back to that place of residence. So far from being antithetical to this idea of reintegration, the ordinance seems to take that into consideration. And again, I repeat, it's pure speculation to say that the ordinance is going to cause that when they haven't got any record to support it. They haven't shown any individual that was caused by Ordinance 34 to not be able to reintegrate into his community. Now, the last argument the plaintiff makes is that because state law, and I quote, allows, end quote, Mr. Riles to live where he does, and that's the same as saying state law doesn't prohibit him from living there, that therefore Ordinance 34, because it forbids him to live in that place, is in conflict. Now, the error in that analysis is that, and the trial court did this as well, they're trying to draw an equation between the word allow and the word authorize. Because what this court's decisions say is that the test for conflict is whether or not a local ordinance forbids, like a state law authorizes, or contrary, that the state, the local ordinance authorizes what the state law forbids. To me, a far cry the difference between authorize and allow. Because let's think about that for a moment. Plaintiffs and the trial court's thesis was, because state law didn't say that Mr. Riles couldn't live where he did in Englewood, therefore they allowed that. Well, if we go with that, then what that's telling us is that anything that the state doesn't forbid is allowed. And since the state allows it, local entities, in particular cities with home rule authority, are prohibited from legislating in any area that the state allows. Well, that basically removes everything. And that can't be what's intended. Instead, what authorizing means is that there's something in the state statute which says you can do this. So for example, come back to the question that was asked earlier about what kinds of state laws might be enacted that would be in conflict. If the state enacted a statute that said you can reside in any residentially zoned neighborhood in any municipality of the state, But it seems to me that's an authorization.
Well, what source of home rule authority is Englewood asserting here? Is it general police power? Is it zoning?
Yeah, health, safety, and welfare.
What does that mean?
That means that it's considered that registered sex offenders might be a danger to the community, in particular children. And in order to provide maximum protection for the children in the city of Englewood, the city has decided that they will limit registered sex offenders from living within certain distances of facilities where children are found to congregate. Now, is it a perfect law? No. Is it foolproof? No, it's not whatsoever. But it's a bona fide attempt to provide an extra measure of safety for the children in the city of Englewood. And the history here is important, and I suspect that the members of the court have seen this in the court trial court's order and in the briefing. But this came on the heels of a circumstance where the state parole board was going to put a sexual predator into a motel in Englewood, a mere matter of feet from a daycare center. And it wasn't considered that the city could do anything about that. And so this got the members of the Englewood City Council, once that issue had subsided, because what happened was a gentleman that basically breached his parole and had to go back to prison anyway, so it never really came to fruition. But it caused them to think hard about what they might do to protect the young children in our community, and this is their attempt.
Council, on that point, can you speak to the concern that your opponents raised that, you know, if Englewood does this and then the neighboring community does this and then, you know, virtually every jurisdiction in Colorado does this, what are we left with?
You know, and that's what I would refer to as
the extraterritorial impact, I suppose, of this particular ordinance.
Mm-hmm. See, that would be what I call a parade of horribles argument, okay? And so the idea is, and I think Judge Jackson even referred to it as a domino effect. His idea was that, you know, Greenwood Village had the ordinance, which was the model essentially for the Englewood ordinance, and that once Englewood enacted its ordinance, then basically all the dominoes would fall and get to the point where there'd be no place in the state for people to live. But let's look at the facts. The facts of the case are, and the record here is that perhaps six or seven municipalities have passed similar ordinances, not all the same, but in some way restricting the residence of sex offenders. That's out of 271 municipalities in the state and 64 counties. So well over 300 public entities that would arguably have the ability to legislate in this area, although I would admit that counties are a little bit different. And I don't think we need to go off on that side discussion, but they could enact an ordinance in this area. So we got over 300 and we've got six or seven. It doesn't strike me as being the pervasive effect that would then lead to a conclusion that there's an operational problem here whatsoever. I mean, if the record was different, if every city in the state had enacted one of these, then it might be a different case, but we don't have that case here today. I have about 3 minutes left, so I think what I'd like to do is reserve the balance of that. For
certainly.
The thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court. We're here today because the city of Englewood passed an ordinance that bans persons required to register as a sex offender, almost everyone in that category, from living in over 99% of the city of Englewood. And that type of sweeping ban, that type of, we know this is a statewide issue, we know people who are released from prison for sex offenses have to live somewhere, but you can't live here, that's what preemption law is all about. Preemption law says one community cannot push a statewide issue and a statewide problem to the other communities in the state. And fundamentally, that's what Judge Jackson found after a four-day trial in this matter.
Could I stop you there?
Sure.
So are you saying then there doesn't have to be a conflict with state law?
There is a conflict with state law.
What does that mean, that members of one community can't push a problem to another community?
So in an area where the state has regulated, and regulated thoroughly, and regulated comprehensively, it creates a conflict with state law where a municipality says, Whatever the statewide scheme is for managing this as safely as possible, we're not going to have it here. And I think the natural resources cases, frankly, are quite instructive on this, because there are two of those cases where you have localities saying we're banning this outlay, and in both instances, this court said, we have a statewide scheme that doesn't say you can drill in the city of Greeley, and now we have the Voss case, which was one of this court's opinions of Greeley. The state statute didn't say you can drill in Greeley, and Greeley said, no, we're going to ban Greeley. What the statute said is we're going to give to the Oil and Gas Commission the authority to regulate drilling to make it as safe as possible in the state. And when Greeley passed an ordinance that completely banned drilling in Greeley, this court said that interfered with the statewide system of management of oil and gas drilling. And the second case, and Greeley was a home rule city just like Englewood. The second case that follows that same fact pattern is the Colorado Mining Association versus Summit County case. This was now a decade prior. This was in the early 90s when there was huge concern about chemicals that were used in mining processes. And in that case, Summit County said you can't use arsenic and similar chemicals in mining in Summit County. Once again, what the state statute there said was that you can mine in any county in Colorado. What the state statute did was delegate to the Reclamation Mining Board, or the authority to regulate mining and to regulate chemicals that are used in mining such that it's as safe as possible for the state. And in that case, what this court said is, you can't opt out of that system as a county. You can't just say, not here, deal with your mining in a different county.
And is that because one community was pushing the problem off on another, or is it because those enabling legislation in those cases could be construed to have the state place in one place the authority to pass a statewide regulatory system?
Both prongs of that are relevant. Let me explain how. The first question you need to ask, according to the case law, is this a matter of statewide concern, or is this a matter of mixed state and local concern? We did not concede at the 10th Circuit that it was only a matter of mixed concern. We argued in the alternative that it's 10th Circuit, it's a matter of statewide concern, or alternatively a mixed matter. And actually the 10th Circuit said that in its order certifying the question to you. The questions that you ask to figure out if it's a matter of statewide concern include what is the extraterritorial effect? What is the spillover effect? So the questions are, the first question is there a need for statewide uniformity? The second question is there an extraterritorial impact? And then a few other questions. So in that sense, the extraterritorial impact is relevant to the preemption analysis. But if you find it's a mixed matter of state and local concern, then you have to get to the next question, which is there a conflict? And then that conflict can be expressed, implied, or an operational conflict. And that's where the second part of your question arises. So if it's a mixed matter, then yes, you need a statute that it conflicts with. Now, one of the things that we saw in the city's brief and we heard today is the city saying you have to, essentially, their argument boils down to, you have to have express preemption. You have to have a state statute that says this is allowed and an ordinance that says this is not allowed, or the reverse. And that would create a preemption effect. And in your opinion, in the Webb City of Black Hawk case, that was the fact. Once this court said it was a mixed matter of state local concern, it was it became an easy question because you had a direct express conflict. But that's only one of the three branches of your preemption analysis.
I want to return to what Justice Cox had to say, because some of my county cases involved cyanide type of mining that was regulated by the Mine Land Reclamation Board, if I remember the decision, and Summit County wanted to ban that method of mining. And it was a statewide concern because this board had a statewide jurisdiction to regulate types of mining activities. So did you really answer Justice Coates' question?
With
respect to the case you brought up, well, you brought up the Summit County case, and you brought up the Greeley case, which was a total ban on something the Oil and Gas Commission has authority to allow under certain regulations.
Right.
So again, what is the statewide preemptive, you know, so that we don't even get into the mixed matter concern arena?
They really fall into two buckets. And the first one is our criminal justice system, which is a statewide matter. There are several statutes, specific statutes we cited that talk about that. The Lifetime Supervision Act, what it says in this declaration, I mean, it's quite clear about this. Some sex offenders will be supervised for life. And our legislature, our state law, says that for others, they will be released into the community. And that is a matter of statewide concern, how to regulate people who are released from prison and re-entering our community. And it's worth noting that our state system, which bears no resemblance to what the city of Englewood did, our state system is highly effective. We're a state that's doing this right. We're a state that has a 2.6% recidivism rate as compared to 14% nationally. So Colorado has a very detailed system, and Mr. Rice is right. It involves things like individualized assessment, customized plans, a graduated system where you start out under more supervision, and then you get to a point where you have less supervision, and all you're required to do is register and have an annual home check, and then you can actually petition off the registry. But there will be a stream of people leaving our prisons, our state prisons, and re-entering our society. And what the city of Englewood said, which is just the same as what Summit County said, which is just the same as what Greeley said, is not here. I know there's going to be something that has some danger involved in it. We don't want it in our community. Not here. And I think, Your Honor, the difference with oil and gas drilling or mining gold with arsenic, frankly, those are activities that I think our state legislature recognizes is going to happen, and there are good reasons for those to happen in our state. But in some sense, they're more discretionary than the issue here, because there are people who are going to be released from prison, and the question is, how do we best protect our communities and keep our communities safest? And what our state has done is our state has taken it as a matter of state law in our parole statutes, in the Lifetime Supervision Act, and in the statute that created the Sex Offender Management Board, the SOMB, to say, as a statewide matter, we're going to figure this problem out, and they've done well with it. And what Andrew was just said is not here. And go ahead, Your Honor.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm having a little trouble keeping the two arguments separated, but when we're arguing whether this is state rather than mixed, and when we're arguing about whether the legislature has in effect preempted the area by turning it over to somebody to regulate statewide.
Right.
Misunderstanding by leaving the two, but you weren't suggesting, were you, or were you, that the legislature, by choosing to regulate, can turn a matter into something of statewide interest?
Well, I think what the case law says is we look at what the state statutes are in an area. And I do think that's our legislature choosing to regulate an area. So, for example, if our legislature had, I mean, it's sort of impossible, hypothetical, but if we had no criminal justice system in the state at all, it would make sense that we have municipal courts handling everything. I mean, that bears no resemblance to where we are.
Maybe I should be a little more expressed. I realize that we have indicated that what the legislature has chosen to do is one of the factors we can look at in deciding whether a matter is statewide or mixed, state and local. Do I hear you saying if the legislature chooses to exercise statewide authority to regulate, that turns it into a matter of statewide interest, and therefore we don't have to look for conflict?
No. There are four factors for whether it's statewide or mixed. The first one is the need for state uniformity. And what we had here, we had a trial, and we had testimony about that, and we heard from the state on that, and the testimony from the state official who testified is there is a need for statewide uniformity. And that's in the trial court's findings of fact in this case. The second question is whether there's an extraterritorial impact. And in this case, that's one of the things that troubled Judge Jackson the most. I mean, there clearly is. And they said in their brief that was speculation, but it wasn't. Again, there was trial evidence of the city of Denver upset and concerned about the extraterritorial impact that Englewood's ordinance was having. And frankly, Greenwood Village, this offender who Mr. Rice mentioned at the end, who prompted this ordinance, was going to be placed in Greenwood Village, and Greenwood Village passed one of these ordinances
And the testimony I trialed from the Inglewood official is, we saw that Greenwood Village had done this, and we wanted to stop the state from placing this offender here. So it was an extraterritorial impact. We took Greenwood Village into Englewood, and that continues. Now there are 8 municipalities. The third factor is a matter that's traditionally governed by state or local law. And with that, we both can see there's not a 100-year history here of sex offender management, but the Sex Offender Management Board was established in 1992, which is now over 20 years ago. So this is a closer question on the question of whether it's mixed state or local. And the last of the 4 key factors is this a matter that the Constitution specifically commits either to the state or to the locality, which I think goes right to your question. There are matters that by Constitution are committed to localities. There's an eminent domain issues that come to mind in that respect. This is not one of those areas. Judge Jackson explains that. Our Constitution does not commit sex offender management to localities. The criminal justice system, in contrast, is a matter that is committed to our state's government. We have a state system of courts, we have a state system of prison, we have a state system of parole, all flowing from our constitutional structure as a state. And then there are 2 other factors that the cases acknowledge or considered. Legislative declarations, and we've talked about those in our brief, and Judge Jackson talked about those in his opinion, and the need for cooperation between the state and local government. If their legislature has set up a scheme where there is a need for cooperation, that supports the idea that it's a matter of statewide concern. And that's the case here. So that's the argument for this being a matter of statewide concern. And I think there's a good, fair argument, and we presented that. Judge Jackson disagreed with us and found that this was a mixed question. And we did acknowledge to the 10th Circuit that I think that's a reasonable conclusion as well. I mean, this court's case is kind of sad. You can use the word fuzzy line, but maybe my summary is too long.
You mean there's a lot of magic involved?
Right, because it's hard to imagine, and the cases say this, it's hard to imagine something a locality would have zero interest in, or that the state would have zero interest in. So this is a judgment call, putting it into the bucket. What Judge Jackson said, though, is that essentially giving the city the benefit of the doubt that it's a mixed question, it quite clearly and directly creates an operational conflict. And looking back at this court's cases, one of the things I'm struck by is on that question, what the Bowen-Edwards case says and what other cases say is we need to remand these cases to the trial court to have evidentiary hearings to see if there's an operational conflict. And here, that was done. We had a 4-day trial. We had
So that's a mixed question of fact and law, is that what you're saying? Is that a mixed question of fact and law, whether there's an operational conflict? And if so, what's the standard review?
So we're here on a certification question of law.
Yeah.
I think this, for the purposes that you've taken the case, I think your job is to answer the legal question with the facts as established by the trial court. I don't think at this point, under Rule 21.1, it would be appropriate to reweigh.
Well, so if we're going to write this in your direction, what precisely is the operational conflict?
They really fall into 2 buckets. One is with our system of rehabilitation in the state, to moving offenders who have left prison back into society as safely as possible. As I said, we have a statewide system with a 2.6% recidivism rate as compared to 14%. And what we heard from witnesses at trial is, and what we heard from the witness who worked for the SOMB is that residency restrictions are counterproductive to SOMB's public safety mandate. They make communities less safe. And they do that because what SOMB has found is that having the most supportive community possible for an offender to return to is what does the best to keep recidivism rates as low as possible. And that's not theory. That's what they've empirically studied and found in our state, and that's why we have a 2.6% recidivism rate. So the ordinance that prevents those sorts of situations from happening destabilizes people's lives and increases recidivism. This wasn't hypothetical at trial. We had evidence of the people who tried to move into Englewood and whose lives were horribly disrupted by this ordinance.
May I interrupt right there, because you're kind of at a key point, I think, with regard to your opponent's argument. So how do you characterize that? Do you want to characterize that in then as saying, so that's a mandate, just like a law. Localities, you can't do that, and by doing it, you've been in conflict, and I take it he's saying that's not the case. Or, it seems to me the only other possibility in terms of our law generally with regard to conflict is that the legislature has turned over to the SLMB entirely the authority to, in effect,
right,
legislate or make recommendations in this area.
Which Judge Jackson found that what I'm arguing is it creates an operational conflict. So in other words, we have a parole statute that says, one of the things it says is that parole officers have to provide assistance in sex offenders finding housing. And we had testimony at trial that these municipal residency restrictions make that much more difficult. We had testimony at trial that persons could not be paroled because of these ordinances, because they could not find places to live.
And is that in effect saying the state recommendation then, or the state statute dealing with parole, in effect means locality, you're not allowed to do anything that interferes with the paroles determination about what would be best for these sex offenders?
If you do,
that's a conflict.
If after an evidentiary hearing, the finder of fact determines that it actually, and the standard is, materially impedes what the state is doing with the statute, then yes, it's an operational conflict. And that is what the evidence in this case showed, and that's what Judge Jackson found after the trial. So that's the first bucket. You see, the second bucket is with our state registration scheme, the Sex Offender Registration Act. And what the legislature did there is set up a scheme to promote public safety in the state and said, we're going to have sex offenders register for, it varies depending on the offense, but at least 10 years, at which point, it's not carte blanche, there is an individualized assessment after 10 years. The offender then has to petition, and a judge has to make a determination. But in any event, what the evidence at trial showed is that there was a real and actual conflict created by the City of Englewood's ordinance with keeping an accurate and up-to-date registry. And this was not, as Mr. Rice says, one case out of however many. This was, there were 11 citations issued by the City of Englewood between 2006 and when we did discovery in this case in 2012. And of those 11 citations, and four of them, this is what the record shows, and four of them, the offender either did actually go underground, i.e. drop off the registry entirely, or the police detective who took the registration said there's a serious risk of it. In two of the cases, clearly dropped off the registry, and in the other two, the officer said there's a risk of that. So that's either 4 out of 11 or 2 out of 11. That is materially impeding the effectiveness, the efficacy of our statewide sex offender registry. And just that's noted that in his opinion. So those are the two buckets of real operational conflicts. And this is not an operational conflict with a guideline. One of the arguments we heard from the city and from the Colorado Municipal League is what we're saying is this court should find preemption based on voluntary guidelines that SOMB puts out, and that's not our argument. There are five concrete statutes that this operationally conflicts with. It conflicts with the Lifetime Supervision Act, where the Lifetime Supervision Act says some offenders we're going to supervise for life. Other, and this is it's 18.1.3.1001. Other offenders, we need to reintegrate them into the community. And what Englewood has said is that's well and good, but not here. That's inconsistent with the Lifetime Supervision Act from the statute. We talked about the parole eligibility and the parole department's duty to assist in finding housing, and the evidence that showed that operationally, as a practical matter, after an evidentiary hearing, the court determined that doesn't happen. We talked about the Sex Offender Management Board statute. which really sets up our statewide system for treating and supervising sex offenders, and our statewide system that has created this 2.6% recidivism rate. And then 16.11.7.109, what our legislature said is the SOMB as a body, the board is one of Colorado's most important resources on the treatment and management of adult sex offenders. That's an extraordinary delegation. And what SOMB has said, if you read about this, Your Honor, what SOMB has said is residency restrictions are counterproductive. That's what the evidence of trial shows. You talk about the 2004 report, and Judge Jackson cites and talks about the 2009 report, which is on page 9 of his opinion, and he cites it to the record. And he acknowledges that what it says is that residency restrictions are counterproductive to the goal of community safety.
Can I pick up on that point? Because looking at sort of the evolution of this, I thought a couple of things were very interesting. This 2006 bill that was voted that never went anywhere included a provision that would have permitted localities to impose stricter restrictions than what the bill proposed. And then in this 2011 report, there was also acknowledgement that localities were in fact passing these types of restrictions, and FOMA suggested to the legislature that some blanket uniformity be imposed, and the legislature didn't do anything in response to that. So it seems to me that the SOB has brought this concern to the legislature's attention and has chosen not to do anything. So what do we do with that?
Well, in 2006, the thrust of the law, the bill that was rejected was to impose a statewide residence restriction. And the legislature rejected that. And we can read into that the legislature's determination that statewide residence restrictions are a bad idea. Or we can say, which this court has said more than once, and the US Supreme Court has said, we don't read anything into legislative silence, into legislative inaction. So in 2006, the bill came through with the statewide restriction, got killed in committee. I think it's fair to say the state of our law now is we don't imply into that an intent of the legislature. In 2011, SOMB did ask that the legislature consider banning municipal residency restrictions. No bill was introduced. So we don't even have what we had in the 6th where the state by banning struck down. In 2011, what we have is literally nothing happened. So,
but I guess what is to the extent that I'm just struggling with this a little bit, because to the extent that the legislature has tasked the SOMB with providing recommendations, and the recommendation was this is going on, and in fact it's disrupting uniformity, and it would be a good idea to establish uniformity by prohibiting these types of residency restrictions, and then the legislature didn't do anything in response to that. Is that sort of a different flavor than, say, the 2006 bill that never went anywhere?
The bottom line is, your case law is clear that we don't read anything into legislative silence. That's a mistake. It is something that was happening in the law 20, 30 years ago, and really over the last 10 to 15 years, this court and the U.S. Supreme Court have stopped that and said, no, we could all speculate as to why that happened, what the political influences were, but that's not an appropriate role for the courts to read meaning in legislative inaction. So I understand the question, but that is the state of your case law, and I think it's right.
Mr. Williams, can I bring up a new subject? You ticked off a couple of areas where there's a conflict, and you referred to the parole responsibilities and the SOMB treating and supervising. Mr. Riles wasn't under any of those. How does his individual circumstances, same question that I asked Mr. Rice, how does his individual circumstances affect our analysis? Because I feel we're getting into sort of a hypothetical area.
Right. Well, at trial, we both agreed, and the city specifically conceded, it doesn't get into it. So when it came to the facial as applied issue at trial, what they said, and this is in their reply brief to their motion for summary judgment, the parties, this is Mr. Rice writing, the parties agree that the facial as applied issue applies only to the constitutional claims and not to the question of preemption. And that was repeated by Mr. Rice, actually I think quite articulately in his closing argument,
at trial where he said, the last thing I want to talk about is this issue of remedy. And this really gets to the issue about whether or not we're talking about a facial challenge versus an as-applies challenge, because the court was to find that there's no constitutional and permanent law. And I speak here not about preemption, because I think that's a completely different issue. There, what you're saying is the state occupied the field, so your law is no good, you can't pass the law. This is at page 687 of the record. I think that's right. What preemption is looking at is this an area where the municipality is lawfully regulated? And that has nothing to do with Mr. Riles' individual circumstances. So at a fundamental level, the only question that's relevant is what is the state of the state law, what is the state of the municipal ordinance, and then, as this court said in cases like Boeing Edwards, for operational conflict, we need to look at the, and BDS is the other case where this comes up. In a case of an operational conflict, we need an evidentiary hearing to see how the ordinance is playing out, not with the specific plaintiff in the case, but what is the operational conflict with the statewide scheme?
So we're juxtaposing the ordinance and the state law in dismissing the individual circumstances.
Correct. And then what we heard from the city is, well, look at the Barra case, which we had a municipal ordinance that said unrelated registered sex offenders can't live in the same residence if it's more than one. And what this court said is we're gonna write an opinion that applies only to foster children. But the issue there, the question that was posed in that case is, did the children's code preempt the municipal ordinance? And the children's code, of course, only regulated foster children. So what defines the scope of our analysis is the scope of the statewide statute, not the individual circumstances. And I guess I would just note as a last point, I think the framework that the city is applying here is really looking at this issue in a vacuum. Because Mr. Riles, he's sitting here, Mr. Riles didn't come out of prison and then just end up on the registry and that was that. He went through the state system, which started with treatment he received while he was incarcerated. It included intense supervision on parole. And then it includes what it includes now, which is supervision through the registry and annual home checks. And we have a system that's regulated for a reason. We have a system that incentivizes people who are released from prison to do the right thing, do their therapy, be compliant, get the help they need such that they can be in a position where they're off parole, where the supervision is a matter of being on the registry. So we don't have a plaintiff, put positively, we have a plaintiff in this case who was on parole, who went through that system, and part of that system for some offenders, like Mr. Riles, is that it comes to an end. And for some offenders, it's that it doesn't come to an end. But that's all part of the whole, it's all part of one piece. So I do, for that reason as well, I don't think it would be proper to sort of chop up the analysis in that.
All right. Appreciate your answer. Thank you.
Council, may I ask one last just procedural question? You raised some constitutional claims as well, and I assume those were not addressed by the district court because the court concluded that the statute was preempted. Are those claims still live in the federal litigation?
Well, they are. And under the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, Judge Jackson did not rule on those. Were the 10th Circuit to reverse, we would get remanded back down to the trial court for the court to address those two claims.
Thank you.
Other questions?
So you're comfortable with a holding that rests on the operational conflict in the findings? You're not arguing for the statewide preemption?
I'm comfortable either way. I mean, that's the most brief. I think there's a lot in the record to support saying this is a matter of statewide concern. Right. I think when we look at the extraterritorial impact, the idea that this could force people to have nowhere to live, and that really animated the judge's decision. I think the court could go there. In Ibarra, that was a matter of statewide. The court said that was a matter of statewide concern, and the court split 4-3. I think it's an easier case to say it's a mixed matter because there's such a clear operational conflict. But in all fairness, I actually think both are correct under the case law.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Just
a handful of points to come back on. The thought was floated that the state doesn't give any authority to local entities to handle sex offenders, and that's just not true. In fact, CSOAR itself makes the registration function occur through local governments, and the local governments are the ones who are charged with the responsibility to enforce it. And that, of course, is the statute which is the basis for Ordinance 34. So there is indeed in this circumstance a situation where the local government is given some control and authority over sex offenders. The question is asked about whether or not there's a conflict and where is the conflict, and I had the same thought. So if there was a conflict between the state and Englewood with regard to Ordinance 34, would there not be evidence of that? There's no evidence in the record whatsoever of the state ever taking the position that Ordinance 34 is preempted by state law. There isn't any evidence of any conflict between parole officers, probation officers, and City of Englewood officials with regard to Ordinance 34. The only evidence that was offered in that regard was from a public defender and the executive director of SOM, and they were talking generalities about these ordinances. But there isn't any hard evidence of any operational conflict between Ordinance 34 and any operation of the state.
I take it your opponent's argument when we talked about operational conflict and tried to narrow down some was very much along the lines that, well, simply by impeding the parole board or whoever's ability to assist would be an operational conflict.
And Justice Coates, this to me then speaks to this issue about where is the conflict between a specific law and Ordinance 34. Because what we hear about is we hear about goals and we hear about policies, okay? And to me that seems like a very slippery slope. Because if all we had to do to enact, to cause something to be preempted, is to have the state come in and say, wait a second, that's inconsistent with our goals, that's inconsistent with our policies, then that would seem to me that that would take away any semblance of home rule authority that cities have, because the state is stripped away not by acting legislatively, but simply saying you're acting inconsistent with our goals. And I don't know of any case from this court that so holds. The bottom line to this is that if the state truly believes Ordinance 34 and laws like it are inconsistent with the state's goals, the state's policies, the state knows how to fix that. They can legislate. And in fact, the SOM invited them to do that, and they didn't do it. So our view is that there has been no preemption in this case, and as a result, we ask the court to stop. Thank you very much for your time and consideration.
All right, thank you very much. We appreciate the argument of both counsel, Mr. Rice, Mr. Williams.